Tom Woods Show, episode 1570.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, the 2020 Contra Cruise promises to be the best one ever. Not only are we being joined by Dave Smith and Scott Horton, not only is there going to be a roast of Dave Smith, but we're also going to be joined by Phil Labonte, vocalist for the band All That Remains. Get the details and book your cabin at ContraCruise.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Very glad to welcome back to the program our old friend, Mark Skousen. If you have heard of the Freedom Fest conference that goes on every year in Las Vegas, well, that is Mark's project. He's the founder of that event, which he continues to direct to this day. But Mark is a scholar, author of many books, a college professor, and an investment newsletter publisher. As a matter of fact, Mark's investment newsletter, Forecasts and Strategies, is actually celebrating its 40th year of publication. And Mark was recently at the American Economic Association meeting and had some rather interesting observations, and I thought I would have him join us to talk about those and some other topics. Mark, welcome.
Oh, it's good to be with you, Tom. Always look forward to your podcast.
I appreciate that very much. All right, I want to get your report from, I guess you were at, what was the American Economic Association meeting?
Yeah, I've attended a lot of these over the years, and it's really a great opportunity to meet up with top economists and to confront them on some of the issues of the day and so forth. And this one in particular was quite unusual. Now, it was held in San Diego, which is nice weather-wise, because normally they're in Chicago and New York and Philadelphia, and it's always the first week in January and you're freezing to death. But San Diego had balmy weather, and it was really fun to meet up with people, even though I did propose a session, a paper on gross output, which was rejected. And when I was looking at the program, I was shocked to see 41 sessions on gender bias and sex discrimination, plus many other papers as well. And the reason is Janet Yellen, the first female president of the AEA, was in charge, was the current president, and approved these 41 sessions. I mean, I thought it was crazy at the time.
That is crazy. Now, can I assume that all 41 of these are more or less putting forth the same thesis, or are some of them pushing back and saying, a la Thomas Sowell and others, that there might be explanations apart from discrimination for discrepancies?
Yeah, it was interesting because Janet Yellen, in her introduction to the Richard T. Ely lecture, which is the big lecture to all economists, and it was packed, was a professor, Marianne Bertrand, from the University of Chicago, who is an expert on the issues of sex discrimination and gender bias and so forth. And it was interesting because Janet Yellen introduced her and painted a very negative picture how economists are biased, that there are very few female economists, and that the situation is dire, and there's all kinds of problems of not only discrimination, but sexual harassment as well. But then when Professor Bertrand got up and gave her talk, and the talk was Gender in the 21st Century, she went to great lengths to say how things had really improved and that women are playing a bigger role and they're getting paid more and the gender gap is narrowing, and it was all very positive. But I will tell you that there was so much repetition. I mean, I printed out the 41 breakout sessions, and they do try to create different topics, like there was women in central banking, promoting female participation in undergraduate economics, black women in the economics profession, gender and entrepreneurship, differential treatment, the role of gender, race, ideology, and affirmative action. And there I thought on something like that, well, they had another one, pink papers, LGBT economics, gender and economics profession. And there was a lot of repetition. 25 years of feminist economics, origins, achievements, and challenges, female leadership in business and politics, leader ladies, race, gender, and economic security. I mean, there was so much, well, the Irby, the radical economists were there, feminist, radical political economy, reproduction and production. But from what I could tell, there was nobody there representing the Thomas Sowell point of view. I mean, Mark Perry, for example, has really gone after the universities for discrimination, basically sex discrimination in favor of women, because, you know, the legal system known as Title IX prohibits discrimination. It doesn't say you have to do affirmative action for women, but that's the way it's been interpreted. And Mark Perry could have been a perfect person to speak on this subject, but he was nowhere there to be seen, did not present a paper, maybe wasn't even asked. I mean, even Deirdre Mikulski, who's the ultimate transgender economist, was not at this meeting. And it was all about women issues. So it was a little bit hit and miss in that respect.
I've had Mark Perry on at least a couple times, and one time to talk about this particular issue. And he's been so good on it. One of the points he makes is that they claim that they're comparing apples and apples because they say they're comparing full-time male workers with full-time female workers. But full-time is a sketchy concept because it can mean anything above 35 hours or more. Well, it turns out women are much more likely to be working in the 35 to 39-hour range, and men tend to be more likely to work in the upper 40s range. And when you correct for this difference between them, you've already reduced the gap to just a 12 percentage point gap. And then even that can be explained by other factors. I mean, just that alone. And in fact, when you get it down to 12%, well, guess what other prominent institution in American society had a 12% gender gap in pay? The Obama White House. And so when the press secretary was asked about this, his answer was, well, men and women do different things in the Obama White House. Exactly. That's the point.
Well, I've been corresponding with Mark Perry as well. And in fact, for the first time, he's coming to Freedom Fest this year. And his topic is, and I'll give you the quote, "Civil Rights for All, My One-Man Mission to Expose Higher Education's Brazen Violations of Title IX's Prohibition of Sex Discrimination." And it's kind of a lengthy title, but he makes that point as well. Plus, he also shows that in almost every discipline, women are dominating now. They certainly dominate in terms of attendance at universities, and they're moving in a lot of areas. One area that has always been a struggle is on Wall Street, of course. It's still very much a male institution, but there's always rational explanations for this. And in fact, there was a paper done that was recently published in Econ Watch. A couple of professors did a study from the University of San Diego, and for some reason I couldn't meet them at the AEA meetings, but they did a paper saying the evidence is overwhelming that there's no discrimination at all at UC campuses throughout California. So there's a lot of upbeat progress. So I did appreciate the Gender in the 21st Century, Richard T. Ely lecture that Marion Bertrand from University of Chicago gave, because she was showing that there was a lot of progress in that area. But I will tell you, at the end of her speech, she took off after Jordan Peterson as an intellectual misogynist, which was really incredible. You know, he's our keynote speaker at this year's Freedom Fest and has taken on a lot of these issues. But to say he's a misogynist who hates women, I mean, that was just appalling that somebody in an academic environment would make that kind of statement.
Of course, I agree with you on that. Let's talk a little bit about another topic that was raised at the meeting, and that is modern monetary theory. And you mentioned in some notes to me that Greg Mankiw was there talking about it. Lawrence Kotlikoff chaired the session, but Randall Ray was also there, and he's a proponent of modern monetary theory. Did these people face off against each other?
No, they didn't. There was actually two sessions. One was by proponents. I think it was a separate session from the AEA. I may be wrong about that. But I just noticed that Randall Cray, who was one of the authors of this macroeconomic textbook, I did a review for the Atlantic Economic Journal. And so I attended it, and Greg Mankiw was in the audience. So we had this wonderful debate with these heterodox economists, largely Marxist in their point of view, and Randall Ray is one of them with the Levi Institute. So I raised the issues. I confronted them. No one else confronted this guy. In fact, Greg Mankiw was relatively quiet in this session, just listening. I think he was there because he had this paper later on Saturday regarding MMT. But I confronted him. I said, how can you write a whole book on macroeconomics and not have a chapter on economic growth? It was all about redistributing income and all that sort of thing. It was really a major disappointment. And then I said, so how is it that you leave out of your textbook four examples of countries who have rejected MMT but have gotten back to full employment? And I mentioned Sweden in Europe. I mentioned Canada in North America. I mentioned Chile in South America. And then in Asia, I mentioned Singapore. So I used these four examples. I said, you know, you had big sections on Japan and their secular stagnation and all that sort of thing. But you had nothing on these countries that refused to run huge deficits. In fact, engaged in supply side economics, reduced the size of government, and achieved all the goals that you want to achieve in terms of healthcare and a welfare system and economic growth and higher wages. They did all of this. How do you explain that? Ray's answer was total silence. I never said a word. It's pretty sad commentary.
Yeah. Well, you know, this whole modern monetary theory thing, it's so destructive that even somebody like Paul Krugman can be found to say sensible things about it from time to time.
So, you know, is this the only time that you've ever had anything good to say about Paul Krugman?
Well, every now and again, the old man stumbles into a truth here and there, and we're happy to acknowledge it. But even somebody like Greg Mankiw, I've got my differences with, but he, or Kotlikoff, certainly I'd have my differences with, but at least they get the problems with this thing. I'm going to, because that's a very difficult topic, actually, modern monetary theory. It's very slippery. Well, just when you think you understand it, they claim that you haven't understood it at all. It's one of these things. You have to be some kind of adept, I can't think of the word in the Christian world, a Gnostic or something, like some secret teaching that nobody can possibly master. I mean, how would you summarize it if you had to?
Well, basically, their argument is the crude Keynesian model, that if you have all these goals that you want to achieve in terms of full employment, in terms of healthcare for all, Medicare for all, minimum wage, and so on, you just can spend whatever you want. There is no discipline. There is no limit on how much you can spend in fiscal policy to achieve it. And so you run deficits indefinitely until you achieve all your goals, and it won't cause inflation. It won't cause any trouble at all because you have unemployed resources. So it really is not so much Marxist, I think, as kind of a crude Keynesian depression model. And what was interesting about Greg Mankiw's paper was that he said he blamed this on the financial crisis coming out and so forth. And even more so, he said the only reason modern monetary theory is popular is because Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and AOC came out in favor of it, and that's why it's popular. And, Professor Kotikoff, he made the point. He said, no, it's because of supply-side economics, because the supply-siders don't think deficits matter. And that's really true. I mean, if you talk to Steve Moore and others, they don't think deficits really matter, and especially now with interest rates so low. And that's one of the problems. They're in charge in the Trump White House, and deficits are going through the roof. So I thought that that was a pretty interesting observation to kind of look internally. I mean, supply side economics is great in many ways, but it also has a major defect in that they think that tax cuts can pay for themselves, and revenue without economy is never sufficient. So that's one of the problems I think you have with supply side economics. And by the way, there are virtually no supply siders at the AEA meetings that I could surmise.
Let me ask you, one of the criticisms that you've had of some Austrian economists is that they're so, as you say, consistently bearish that they miss a lot of opportunities, like investment opportunities, because they're just so bearish all the time. But couldn't somebody come back at even somebody like Mark Skousen and say, your complaints about deficits seem to ring hollow because they happen every single year as well. Oh, the deficit is so terrible. And it doesn't seem like there's been any real catastrophe. So maybe the deficits don't matter crowd is right after all. How would you answer that?
Well, in fact, this session where Greg Mankiw spoke on MMT was on the topic, is the U.S. deficit policy playing with fire? And I was really impressed with the economists there who all said it was a Ponzi, the deficit spending was a Ponzi scheme, and that it was putting on a burden to the next generation and that we'll have to pay for it at some point. So it was really a sound kind of classical argument that was being made there by modern economists. But yes, I think that's a legitimate complaint in the sense that these deficits seem to go on and on and on, just like the predictions that were the crash is imminent, is coming around the corner. So, I mean, that's a legitimate argument because I have been worried about this, and I do believe that a monetary crisis is coming, but far be it for me to predict when it would, because you need to have the inverted yield curve, you need to have a tight money policy adopted by the Fed, and they just have gotten away with this easy money policy for a long, long period of time. So maybe I'll turn the tables on you and say, well, what do you think? Do you think that this is a time bomb, an economic time bomb that will explode eventually? I mean, I think so.
I think so too, but I give up trying to time it. I mean, for example, when the 2008 economic financial crisis took place, I have to say I was surprised that we'd gone that long without something as serious as that. So, I mean, the system maybe is more resilient than I've thought. I don't quite know. I am interested in to know that Ben Bernanke apparently wants to go beyond the 2% inflation target. Now, well, first of all, would you mind explaining to a lay audience what inflation targeting is as a strategy for the Fed? Because I think it should be, first of all, everybody's red flag should be going up there. You know, red flag should be everywhere with inflation targeting. We need inflation to be at least 2%. That's sort of considered the conventional wisdom, and yet to me, it couldn't be more obviously bad.
Well, yeah, and initially, the Federal Reserve was created in 1913. One of its goals was to defend the dollar and to make sure that inflation was held in check. But that's changed, and now we've adopted this quasi-Keynesian view that we need to have a certain amount of inflation is good for the economy. And it comes straight out of the Keynesian perspective. And they use the CPI, Consumer Price Index, as a measure of this, and they've had the dickens of a time getting it up to 2% according to their official statistics. And so Bernanke thinks, well, maybe you need to be more expansionary to get the CPI to go up. You need more quantitative easing. He said quantitative easing is now he spoke to a plenary session at the AEA meetings on. He was introduced by Janet Yellen. And Janet Yellen just profusely, I mean, said that we owe a huge debt of gratitude for Ben Bernanke, his courage to act, is the title of his book, you know, to do this and to inflate to get a recovery. And yeah, and so in his speech, he made two statements. Quantitative easing should be a permanent new tool that should be used. And then we need to raise the inflation target. CPI needs to increase more than 2% a year. And we need to do whatever is necessary to achieve that. So they really fear deflation terribly. And yet we know if you're at full employment, deflation can be quite beneficial because it means a lower cost of living, as Murray Rothbard was always making a point about that.
But these days, that could not be more out of fashion. I mean, I guess there are maybe some economists who, with George Selgin, might admit that there is such a thing as growth deflation, right? I mean, some of them have to.
Paul, the late Paul Volcker, in his biography, his last book, said that inflation targeting was insane and that there's nothing wrong with deflation. And he pointed to the 50s and other time periods where you had a gradual deflationary policy and it wasn't bad at all. So there are economists out there who reject this notion. By the way, I really need to disagree very much with Janet Yellen on this, that we owe a huge debt of gratitude to Ben Bernanke for The Courage to Act, the title of his book. Because it didn't take any courage at all. We're all taught this in basic macro classes that if you have a financial crisis, the solution is inject liquidity, which is exactly what he did. He injected liquidity. Now, he did do the quantitative easing, the actual direct buying of mortgages, these subprime mortgages, as well as buying direct treasury securities. And it is a problem. And by the way, in September of last year, you know, we had this mini monetary crisis. Very little has been played up. I don't know if you've talked about it at all, but the repo market, the repurchase agreement market, the money market, the rates jumped up to 10%. And you know why they jumped up to 10%? Because the Treasury was borrowing money so fast that the repo institutions panicked and thought, wow, this is crazy. And so the Fed had to intervene. They had to buy $75 billion overnight directly from the Treasury, quantitative easing. And that's the reason they cut the interest rate at this time. It wasn't because the economy was slowing down. It was this financial panic. And so that's why I think this kind of thing could go on further if the government just keeps spending like crazy and running these huge deficits. But anyway, getting back to Ben Bernanke, I still remember his talk at the AEA meetings in 2007 in Chicago, just after he had become president. And he gave this luncheon speech and passed out a copy of his speech called Bank Regulation. And it was just incredibly Fed speak, really boring. And finally, I started looking and I noticed he used the words panic and crisis over and over again. And so I went through his luncheon speech in 2007, January of 2007, and circled how many times he said crisis and panic. And it was 34 times in this talk. So I think subconsciously he knew that a panic was coming, but he's the chief banking officer. He knew, because he was also a member of the Fed, he knew about the subprime loans. He knew about the no-doc loans. And as Fed chairman, he allowed it to continue. And I think that anybody who was the CEO, you know, of any of these banks that ran into trouble, they all had to resign. So I think Ben Bernanke should have resigned, not because of the QE2 and stuff like that, but because he did a bad job as the chief bank regulator.
I remember those days well. And we, of course, thankfully this time through, had the benefit of social media. And people, average people, were able to compile clips of what the Federal Reserve chairman had told us for years and just run them one after the other for the public to see that the emperor had no clothes. We would have been helpless before. But now, I remember after that crisis, the Fed hired a PR firm and you saw Ben Bernanke on 60 Minutes. This was not a phenomenon you would have observed before. They were very much on the defensive as a result of that.
Yeah, really. I don't think we owe him a huge debt of gratitude. I think he could have helped. Maybe it was too late once he was Fed to do anything about the subprime and no doc loans. But this was pure fraud. This was banking fraud that was going on. And, you know, in other countries, they didn't allow it, in Canada at all, in Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, even in France, they didn't allow subprime loans. It was only the UK and the United States. And that's where the major financial crisis. The problem was, of course, everybody held this mortgage debt all around the world, and so it did become a worldwide phenomenon, and it was an interesting episode, and I have been bullish ever since. I should tell you that I have been 100% invested in the market since early 2009. That was one of my better calls, but I am a little bit more worried now that we are at some point, some kind of a black swan event could occur in 2020 or beyond. And I'm not normally a doom and gloomer, But I do think at these lofty levels with the Dow at all-time high and so forth. And by the way, there was another big session with Larry Summers and his secular stagnation thesis. And it was really nice to see Valerie Ramey, who's a top professor from UC San Diego, really debunk in many ways this secular stagnation thesis, which even Tyler Cowen and Peter Thiel, of all people, are in this camp. And as she pointed out, it's a slow growth economy. It's a slow growth in productivity, but it still is growing. And to call it stagnation is just totally incorrect. And especially the call for more government spending, which is what Larry Summers predicted. It was a standing room only session that really was a put down time period for Larry Summers. It was pretty funny.
I want to make sure before we wrap up that I cover two specifically Mark Skousen topics. And one of them has to do with gross output, which is a concept that you've been interested in getting people to understand and even to be used as part of national income accounting, probably at least since your book, The Structure of Production, I would assume. And you've had tremendous victories with this. First of all, explain, what is it about gross output that captures something about the economy that we would miss otherwise? And then secondly, what's happened with the concept in terms of the public eye since you started writing about it?
Yeah, so gross output is the term that the government uses, the BEA, Bureau of Economic Analysis, in the Commerce Department. They're the ones who put out GDP statistics and so forth. And I had advocated for some time that we needed a top line in national income accounting that is something that measures spending at all stages of production. For those of you familiar with Hayek and Hayek's triangle, it's a measure of Hayek's triangle. In just in general terms, the best way to explain is what Steve Forbes used. He did an interview with me on his podcast a few months ago, and he said GDP is an X-ray of the economy. Gross output, GO, is a CAT scan. And what he meant by that was you get a much bigger picture of what's happening in the economy when you look at the total spending at all stages of production, from the raw commodity and the resource through the production, wholesale, retail, the whole economy in general. And for those who are in finance and you watch CNBC and so forth, when publicly traded companies release their quarterly financial statement, they have a top line and a bottom line. The top line is sales or revenues, and the bottom line is profits. But I've argued that in economics, we need to do the same thing that we do for accounting and finance. So we need a top line, and that's gross output. It's spending at all stages of production. And then GDP is the spending just on the finish, the final product that you and I buy in the retail stores and the showrooms and that sort of thing. So the top line, GO, is about $46 trillion, according to the last quarterly report, and GDP is around 21. So you can see that spending in the economy is much bigger. Well, what's the benefit of that? Well, first of all, it shows you that business spending is much bigger than consumer spending. So it exposes the myth that consumer spending drives the economy. It's business and the supply side that drives the economy. GO is also much more volatile. It's a much better representation of the business cycle. During the 2008 financial crisis, GO fell like 15%. While GDP dropped maybe 2 or 3%. So that can show you how GO does a better job. Plus, GO is a really good leading indicator. It tells you where the economy is headed. And lately, it's been rather bullish for the Trump administration, the economy. There's no indication of a recession, according to the GO statistics. Anyway, the good news is at the AEA meetings, I met up with Brian Moyer, who's the director of the BEA, and he told me that starting in September, GO and GDP will be released at the same time. So finally, here it is, the 21st century. Economics has caught up with finance and accounting, with the top line and bottom line accounting coming out at the very same time. So I'm very happy with that. There are academic articles on it, textbooks. Some of the top textbooks are now including GO. Who knows? Even George Mason University, GMU, at some point may get excited and have me give a lecture on GEO.
Well, that'd be great. I think the more people know about it, the better. And speaking of which, this is a ham-handed segue, but another thing people should know about is, of course, the event that you've been doing. How many years now, July in Las Vegas?
Yeah, this will be our 14th year. I've lost track a little bit myself. We started in 2007, and we do it. Freedom Fest is an intellectual feast of libertarians and conservatives, and really anybody of all political perspective who have a free mind, an open mind. And we have several thousand people who come every year, and we talk philosophy, history, science and technology, politics, economics, healthy living, music, dance. It's a little bit of everything. And this year, it's July 13th through the 16th, which turns out to be the exact same dates as the Democratic National Convention. So if you want to get away and do other things, come to Las Vegas at the Paris Resort Hotel. And I am very pleased to announce that Tom Woods is coming to Freedom Fest. So we are very excited about that.
Thank you. It's the first time I've been there in a long time. I think I was there back around 2010. That was the first time I ever had a chance to meet Gene Epstein.
Oh, yeah.
Because he and I did a debate against a couple of other people. That was a lot of fun. And by the way, I have to say, it's one of my favorite debate stories actually comes from Freedom Fest, because Warren Coates was one of the economists on the other side of that debate. And he is an object lesson in why you need to pace yourself in your opening statement. Because he got up there and he began his statement in behalf of the Fed by saying, now listen, I admit the Fed has a lot of problems and the Fed has made a lot of mistakes. And he went and listed a bunch of these. And then he ran out of time. He never got to say all the good things. And make a note to yourself. Don't let that happen.
You won that debate, I take it.
Yeah, I don't think it was a Oxford style, unfortunately. So I would have been very glad to see the numbers, but it was a great chance to get to. In fact, I remember, I probably shouldn't mention this, but who cares? Too late, my show. There was a night when you and I and Gene were at Morton's Steakhouse in New York, and Gene just was riding you all night. He would not let go of that you should have Oxford-style debates at Freedom Fest and why they're superior. And so first we thought, well, this is kind of charming. But then he just kept hammering away. This is a major, major thing to Gene, is the Oxford style, where the audience votes.
It really is, and we have finally succumbed to his pressure tactics, and we do the Oxford-style debate. But, you know, when we had Paul Krugman come and in 2015 and debate Steve Moore, we did the Oxford-style, and of course, guess who won?
Paul Krugman. Yeah, because Steve starts with all the support. He has nowhere to go but down.
Exactly. So there are some problems with this Oxford-style debate. It's not my I think you need both. But to say, I'll give you an example of this. John Mackey and Catherine Ward debated two socialists in New York, Oxford style. And of course, John Mackey and Catherine Ward, they clearly won. They had 62% of the vote or something like that. But of course, they all said they lost. But when you talk to John Mackey, he said, we just blew him away. And so, I mean, it's just a little bit odd that the Oxford style debate is, I think it results in some rather peculiar results that don't really, that in a sense mask what really went on. To say that John Mackey lost this debate is just wrong, because he actually increased the number of people supporting him. And when it was all through, 62% of the people agreed with the thesis that capitalism was a better system than socialism. So I don't know.
Now that I think about it, Mark, I absolutely guarantee there's a 100% likelihood that I'm going to get an email in my inbox from Gene, you and me. We're going to get one tomorrow. Like, you know that. That's an email is coming about the merits of Oxford style debates. You know that.
He's going to want to be on your podcast and talk for for 30 minutes on this subject.
Yeah, he's going to want to have an Oxford-style debate about Oxford-style debates. So I'm not going to allow that to happen. But anyway, so I'll be at, is it freedomfest.com?
Yep, freedomfest.com. And I mentioned Jordan Peterson as our keynote speaker. And we have Matt Ridley is coming for the first time as well.
Oh, I love him.
Yeah, and Mark Perry and so forth. So we're going to really have a lot of fun at this conference. And it also happens to be the 40th anniversary of the publishing of my newsletter, Forecasts and Strategies. So we're going to have a big investment conference there as well for those of you who are inclined toward, are we headed for another monetary crisis? Are the doom and gloomers finally going to be right?
Well, it sounds great, which is why I couldn't resist it this year. So I'm looking forward to being there, and I'm looking forward to seeing a great many of you folks listening right now there as well. So freedomfest.com is where you should go. I'll have some interesting links related to the topics we discussed today at tomwoods.com/1570. That's 1570. And Mark, thanks again for your time.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks a lot, Tom.
All right, folks, before I let you go, it turns out one of my listeners is an accomplished teacher of German. And I want you to check out her website, germanwithlaura.com. Everybody tries to learn German through Duolingo or Rosetta Stone or other popular software, but most people walk away without a deep understanding about how to actually use the language. And that's really Laura's role here. You're going to need more than memorized words and phrases. You need a foundation in the principles and patterns behind how German works. And I studied German myself, and I can tell you that is exactly correct. Well, you can sign up for Laura's number one free training, How to Actually Learn German and Avoid Wasting Years Trying. So head over to germanwithlaura.com to pick up that free training. And speaking of free, I'm giving Laura free publicity for her site because why? She used my link to get her hosting, which means she got an excellent price on her hosting. She gets free publicity from me, nice backlink on my site, which will help her in the search engines, as well as membership in my Mutual Help bloggers group and a couple of dozen video tutorials that I give to all folks who use my link that help you become more adept as a blogger, giving you the technical know-how to do it. It's not that much know-how, but I'll tell you, these tutorials will come in handy as you're getting started. How do you get all these neat bonuses? Before you start your site, check out tomwoods.com/publicity. I'll see you all tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.